Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On a quiet summer morning, 71-year-old Shirley McEwen pulled out of her driveway for the last time. Heading across town to her daughter's new home, Shirley was helping out with the remodel while her daughter was out of town. On this morning, though, she never made it to her destination. 10 long days passed before the first clue emerged. Shirley's white Cadillac DeVille was found abandoned and concealed beneath brush, tree branches, and a tarp just a mile from her daughter's home. The back seat was soaked in blood, and what had begun as the search for a missing woman transformed into the search for her body and the hunt for a killer. Witnesses had seen four men in the car. Surveillance video captured them 30 miles away in the white Cadillac. This evidence eventually led to two people, but the evidence necessary for an arrest lingered just out of reach. Now police rely on locals, people who know the truth, to come forward and break the case open, or remain silent and allow the killers to strike again. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 160, The Disappearance of Shirley McEwen. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the mysterious and frustrating disappearance of Shirley McEwen. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 71-year-old Shirley McEwen had dedicated her life to caring for others, both as a nurse and a mother. Then one quiet Saturday morning, all of that ended when she mysteriously vanished. This is episode 160, The Disappearance of Shirley McEwen. The late summer sun slowly crept up from the eastern horizon, blazing shades of pink and orange painting the sky like watercolors against graying puffs of cloud. It was already hot and humid, the kind of morning that sees darkening strips of sky beginning to assemble beyond the haze where soft winds offer little comfort, the sticky, wet atmosphere dripping like warm honey over heated skin. Tree limbs revel in the breeze, their dry leaves crackling with thirst as the clouds continue mounting, a summer storm threatening from the east. Cracked pavement simmers, a patchwork of discolored blotches mark the countless potholes filled, broken and refilled, on an aging street in a once picturesque neighborhood. The quiet morning stillness breaks as vehicles approach. A patrol unit moves slowly south down the avenue towards a vacant lot. Steel pops and flexes as the vehicle squeals to a stop, doors swung open casually as an officer surveys the scene. A varied pastiche of homes dot the street, both new and original architecture showing the transformation of the decades. There, in an overlooked space utilized by neighborhood kids as a hangout, a thicket of trees concealing a dark secret soon to be uncovered. Once green blades of grass burnt yellow in the swelter, crunching beneath heavy steps as the officer crosses the curb and proceeds towards the shrubbery. Something seems off, unnatural. Shades of gray peeking out from between the bark and leaves. White nubs show fresh cuts. Broken branches lean and hang end over end, stacked and purposefully placed like the haphazard walls of a fort assembled by children. Yet something sinister is at play. Peeling back the branches, it was quite obvious that whoever had gone through the trouble of trying to keep their secret hadn't tried very hard. There, beneath the branches and brush, a gray tarp sat stretched in the shape of a car. Pulling up from the rear revealed the white body of a vehicle, though where a license plate had once been attached, there was just an empty space. As the officer continued pulling, he found himself looking at the very car they'd been seeking, a white Cadillac that had disappeared 10 days earlier, along with its driver. Glancing through the windows in the front, everything seemed normal. However, turning towards the back seat, the officer spotted a large quantity of blood, partially dried and sticking to the upholstery. Radioing back the details, one thing became apparent. Homicide investigators would be taking over this missing person's case. The extent of the blood spilled suggested a severe and likely fatal wound. A week and a half earlier, 71-year-old Shirley McEwen had pulled out of her driveway and vanished. Now it seemed clear. Shirley hadn't come home because somewhere along the way, she'd been the victim of a violent attack, and the hope of finding her and bringing her home safely was shrinking with each passing minute. However, the hunt for the person or persons responsible was only just beginning. Shirley Ann Cooper was born on Wednesday, January 21st, 1931, to parents Joseph and Myrtle Patricia Cooper. Shirley would grow up in the Castle Rock area of Joplin, Missouri, in a small two-bedroom home situated on Manitou Avenue. It wasn't an easy life, as Shirley was born just 2 years after the Great Depression had hit, and by the time it began turning the corner, she'd already be nearly 10 years old. Life was challenging, money was tight, but together Shirley's parents were focused on providing her with the best life and opportunities they could. From a young age, Shirley showed a tremendous amount of care and affection for her family and others, earning a reputation for having a nurturing sensibility. She was a smart child, doing well in school as well as being socially engaged, joining the Girl Scouts early and making friends. Beyond school and social arenas, Shirley developed quickly a seemingly innate skill when it came to music, and her parents were supportive of that avenue. Throughout her early years, she was a part of the choir in both school and church, and early news articles are jammed with different concerts and events where she took part in singing. As she progressed on, first to South Junior High and then Senior High, her horizons broadened. Shirley was listed as belonging to the Philosophy Club, band, orchestra, and drum corps, among others. She consistently made the honor roll and developed a reputation for being a kind and caring teen who worked hard and set long-term goals. Graduating from high school in the spring of 49, Shirley had her sights set on a career in nursing, and in the fall, she'd go on to attend classes at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City. For the first time, Shirley was living out on her own, more than 150 miles from her parents, but Kansas City struck her, and it would ultimately be the place she'd choose to spend the rest of her life. Her time at school was a mixture of studying, hanging with friends, and riding the train home to Joplin, where she'd spend time with family. After graduating in 1956, Shirley began planning out her future, and a large part of that future would come to fruition just a year later, when on June 1, 1957, she married James Eugene McEwen at St. James Catholic Church. Just a few years after, the new couple would move into the home on East 44th Street, where they would have two daughters, Patricia and Bridget. It would also be the home where James and Shirley would spend the rest of their lives. Throughout the 60s and 70s, Shirley was employed at North Kansas City Hospital, where she received great praise for her steadfast focus, determination, and gentle bedside manner. Never one to rest on her laurels, Shirley would work other jobs throughout her life to fill the time, supplement income, or just keep herself busy. At one point, she worked for Hallmark, at another, in the ticket booth of the Kansas City Royals. She was attentive to her daughters, wanting them to be as engaged and happy as possible, and she was deeply in love with her husband, with whom she shared a powerful and devoted relationship. In what free time a hard-working mother can find, she turned her attention to antiques. They didn't need to be expensive or in immaculate condition. In fact, Shirley's attention was often drawn to those items that needed a little care. Throughout the later years of her life, she frequented flea markets and yard sales seeking out pieces to restore. Whether working the hospital floor or sanding down an antique chair, Shirley had a love for bringing things back to life in as vibrant a way as possible. There was just something about taking old, roughly used chests and drawers, and after hours of elbow grease and care, making them gleam as though they'd just been made. Oftentimes, she'd gift these restored items to friends or her daughters. Sadly, on February 18, 1997, after 40 years of marriage, James passed away at the age of 67. It was a hard time for Shirley, who had spent the vast majority of her life with James, and in the aftermath, she would grow increasingly close with her daughters. While Patricia moved out to the West Coast, Bridget remained in Missouri. And the two, who already had a strong bond, only strengthened their love for one another over the years. Bridget would later tell the Kansas City Star that she and her mother spoke by telephone at least twice a day, and oftentimes when she came home from work, she'd find her mother already there, waiting for a visit. Not long before passing, James had finally indulged himself and purchased a white 1990 Cadillac DeVille. After he was gone, Shirley kept the car in immaculate shape, her own way of showing her husband that even after he was gone, everything of his still meant the world to her. Bridget wasn't thrilled with her mother driving the Cadillac. Things had changed. The old neighborhood had gotten rougher, crime was on the rise, and she feared this could mark Shirley as a target. In a bitter twist of fate, she may have been right. In the winter of 2002, not long after Shirley celebrated her 71st birthday, Bridget purchased a home in the 3400 block of Charlotte Street, just 7 miles to the west of the family home on East 44th. Shirley was excited, not just to see her daughter getting a new home, but also because of the house itself. Built at the turn of the century, it was an absolute dream for someone who loved restoration and antiques. So Shirley kicked her work into high gear, grabbing up vintage items and furniture which she'd restore and gift to her daughter. In fact, she may well have been about to begin a new project the same day she vanished. It was late August, and work was being done on Bridget's new home, and as always, Shirley was directly involved. As the weekend of Friday, August 23rd approached, Bridget had plans which would take her out of town, but her mother was on the job, saying that she'd stop by the house to supervise as painters made their way through. On Friday evening, as they were finishing up for the day, Shirley chatted with the painters about their progress. Gathering up her belongings and making sure the home was secure, she told the workers she'd be back in the morning when they arrived. She exchanged good evenings with the group before climbing into the Cadillac and making the 15-minute trip home. She'd never make it back to the house, and sometime in the next 18 hours, she would disappear. At the time, Shirley was still living in the family home on East 44th and was kept company by her dog. Her usual routine involved allowing the dog out into the backyard while she ran errands or went out for the day. On the morning of Saturday, the 24th, things began as most days did. Waking in the morning, she read the paper and then began getting ready. Moving to the back door, she let the dog out and then proceeded to the front door, pulling it shut behind her, jiggling the knob to ensure it was locked. According to the official timeline, a longtime neighbor and friend saw Shirley walking out of her house between 9 and 9:30 a.m. Climbing into her white Cadillac, she slowly backed out of the driveway, meeting her friend's gaze The two exchanged friendly hellos before Shirley proceeded west towards Laurel Avenue. This is the last confirmed sighting of the 71-year-old. The drive to Bridget's new home wasn't long, and followed a predominantly northwest direction with less than 10 turns involved in the entire trip. Had Shirley made her way there without stopping off, she should have arrived on Charlotte Street well before 10 a.m., but she never did. In fact, what exactly occurred that morning remains unknown. Shirley never got to Bridget's house, and she never made it back to her own. Being an avid yard sailor, it's often been theorized she may have taken a detour to stop off, and perhaps this took her into a dangerous area with which she was unfamiliar. Sadly, no one was aware that Shirley never made it to her destination, and no one seemed to notice or be concerned when she failed to arrive home. No one would notice anything was wrong until more than 24 hours later, when Bridget got back to town. After arriving back in Kansas City, Bridget spent some time taking a look at the work which had been done on her home over the previous 2 days. It wasn't until early afternoon that she began to wonder why she hadn't heard from her mother. Maybe she was just giving her some space to settle back in. Surely, there was nothing to worry about. However, as time continued passing, Bridget couldn't help but feel a small fear growing in the back of her mind. Finally, at 2 p.m., she picked up the phone and placed a call, but there was no answer. It was a Sunday afternoon, so maybe she was out antiquing or taking a nap. What rational explanations Bridget could muster were slowly fading away as over the course of the next 3 hours, every call to Shirley went unanswered. Finally, out of frustration and concern, she started calling neighbors, and it was then that she learned something was very wrong. According to several neighbors, while Shirley had let the dog out Saturday morning, she'd never brought him back in, and he'd spent the whole night in the yard. This was highly unlike the 71-year-old who doted on her pets and was a big lover of animals. The next detail that caught Bridget off guard was when one neighbor took a walk over to the house and noted that while the home itself seemed secure, the Sunday paper was still lying on the driveway and the Cadillac was gone. It would be highly unusual for Shirley to not bring in the paper. It was part of her routine. And it would be even more out of character for her to have left home during the early morning hours before the paper had arrived. Worry now began transforming into panic as Bridget hopped into her car and headed across town to check for herself. Arriving at the house, everything seemed normal. She found the front door locked and, producing a key, let herself in. Walking through, there was nothing out of place, nothing which suggested any problems at all. As Bridget herself later told the Kansas City Star, quote, "It was like she left for the day and never came back," end quote. Curiously, the back door was left unlocked, though it's unknown if this was due to an error on Shirley's part or maybe part of what she normally did. She'd been living in that house for more than 40 years, and while times had changed, old habits die hard. Frustrated and unsure of what else to do, Bridget called the police to report her mother missing. At the time, she felt, investigators didn't take things too seriously. She later noted that she spent half the call just trying to explain that her mother was in good health, showed no signs of memory issues or Alzheimer's, and that it was highly unlike her to be gone and out of contact. While a report was filed, it doesn't seem like investigators rushed right out to start searching for the missing mother and grandmother. Early on, a description of Shirley in her car was passed on to the local media, and several papers ran small blurbs about the missing woman, but not much was done beyond that. And in 2002, the Silver Alert program was still 4 years away. While Bridget initially believed that her mother might have been injured or perhaps had been the victim of a crime, she maintained hope that she'd be found alive and safe. However, as those first days passed with no new information, that hope began to waver. Still, she devoted as much time as she could to traversing the city looking for her mother, making calls to hospitals first in the city and then moving slowly outward. No matter who she called, the answer was always the same. Shirley wasn't there, and no one had seen her. Time began passing. In fact, 10 long, difficult days would pass before any real leads developed, and when they did, they carried a dark implication. At approximately 7 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday, September 3rd, the Kansas City Police received a call from a man who wanted to speak to the detectives working the Shirley McEwen case. When directed to them, the man, whose name has never been publicly released, told investigators that after reading about the disappearance, he had noticed there was a very similar-looking car to Shirley's that appeared to have been abandoned in an empty lot on the street he lived on. At that time, investigators made their way towards the 3300 block of Highland Avenue. This is approximately a mile to the northeast of Bridget's home and would have been an area Shirley would have passed through on her way there. When investigators found the vehicle, it was clear someone had attempted to conceal it, though their efforts were weak and childish. The vacant lot near the intersection of East 33rd Street had several trees, and the car was parked amongst them. Whoever had left it there then covered it with a gray tarp before breaking off random branches and pieces of brush to lay on and around the car in a sort of makeshift camouflage. Police were extremely close-lipped about the condition of the car, reporting publicly only that it had not sustained damage to the body, didn't appear to have been rifled through or ransacked, and that the license plates were missing. Shirley had a vanity plate with the letters MCQN, and the plate itself was stamped with the Missouri Department of Conservation logo, but whoever had left the vehicle there had taken those off. There was one detail, though, that police chose not to share, and it was perhaps the most ominous. Blood was found both in the trunk and back seat, and not just a few drops or the result of a minor injury, but enough to suggest whosoever blood that was had likely been mortally wounded. The discovery of the car and the presence of a large quantity of blood caused the case to change hands, from those investigating missing persons to Kansas City homicide detectives. Bridget, who had been waiting for any word about what might have become of her mother, knew, even before investigators broached the subject, that Shirley had likely been killed. It was a difficult and bitter pill to swallow, to try and imagine what kind of monster would needlessly kill a 71-year-old woman who had given so much of her life to helping others. While it wouldn't have been difficult to slide down into her own grief and pain, Bridget wasn't about to give up. She wanted to find her mother, learn what happened, and perhaps most importantly, see the person or persons responsible pay for what they had done. She had no idea at the time that it would be such a long and difficult road to walk. After investigators processed the car at the scene, they had it removed from the vacant lot so that a forensics team could comb over every inch in search of evidence. Meanwhile, detectives began questioning the man who had initially reported seeing the car. As part of their investigation, they acquired warrants to search both the man's home and property. While detectives had discovered several items connected to Shirley in the car, one piece which was missing was her purse, where she carried her checkbook and credit cards, and so they were hoping to track them down. If anything connected to Shirley was found at the man's home, it's never been reported. Police have stated that that man is not a suspect, and while they don't believe he was directly involved, they consider it possible he may have had some form of contact with those who were. 2 days later, on Thursday, September 5th, investigators received another phone call from a man who wanted to discuss Shirley's case, though this time it seemed this man had more information than just the location of a car. According to the Kansas City Star, this second man, whose name is also not given, was asked to come down to the station to discuss what he knew, and when he arrived, the 18-year-old was flanked by two lawyers. While speaking to police, the man stated that he had come into possession of the Cadillac and had driven it, but was not connected to the crime. He claimed, in what I can only describe as a ridiculous explanation, that he had purchased the car for $55 and only after learning about Shirley had chosen to abandon it in the vacant lot. At the time, he lived with his mother in a home not far from where the car was stashed. Investigators then acquired warrants to search his home and property. At the time, they weren't very forthcoming about what they'd found and would only tell reporters they'd recovered items connected to Shirley. However, at least one item found in the man's possession would become apparent just days later when police appealed to the public for their assistance. A photograph was distributed to the media and printed in newspapers depicting an antique ice cream parlor chair, and investigators wanted to know where it came from. Reportedly, the chair had been present in the Cadillac the day Shirley had vanished and was found by police during their search of the 18-year-old's home. At the time, it was theorized that Shirley might have bought the chair the day she went missing, and maybe, if they could track down its origin, they might have a better idea of where she had been that day. It was later revealed that, in addition to the chair, other items were found at the 18-year-old's home, and the chair, much like the back seat, had blood on it. According to the man, the chair and other items were in the car when he had come into possession of it. In hopes of getting additional information, a reward of $4,840 was put together and announced. Police didn't charge the 18-year-old as, after hours of investigation and interrogation, he wouldn't budge from his original story, and they didn't yet have enough evidence to directly link him to Shirley's abduction or murder. He'd admitted to purchasing the car, driving it, and removing items from it, but alleged that once he'd learned where it had come from, he'd abandoned it. As of yet, I've seen no answers as to how the man didn't know a crime had been committed when he was driving a car with a back seat soaked in blood. Over the course of the next few weeks, police spoke with several witnesses who reported seeing 3 to 4 men in the Cadillac the day Shirley vanished. Tracking Shirley's financial records showed that, on the afternoon of her disappearance, her credit card was used to purchase gas in the town of Olathe, Kansas. After visiting the gas station, police obtained copies of surveillance footage which showed 4 young men with the white Cadillac. Olathe is one of the more populous cities in Kansas and is approximately 30 miles southwest of Shirley's home. Just outside of the city, there are miles of farmland, wilderness, campgrounds, and parks, as well as several bodies of water, any of which could be an isolated enough spot to dispose of a body. Unfortunately, at that point, police began to hit a dead end. All of their leads had brought them to this group of people, but no evidence of their direct involvement in the crime could be established. Without something new to work with, advances in the investigation began stagnating. In November, the reward was increased, this time to $6,700, and police again appealed to the public, insisting that there were people out there who knew more about the case than they had shared. Lead detective Eric Dillenkoffer later told the Star that while Shirley was technically still a missing person, they were planning to provide the blood evidence to the medical examiner in order to have a death certificate issued. At the time, Bridget was struggling to cover the taxes on the Cadillac in her mother's home since without a death certificate, there was no way to handle her estate. Bridget, when speaking to the Star, explained coming to terms with the harsh reality, saying, quote, "I knew my mother was dead, but as long as people were around me, I didn't want to believe it. When I was by myself, I had to say the word, murder," end quote. As the investigation faltered, life for Bridget became more difficult. By late December, she was numb, bitter, and angry. How could someone do this and just get away with it? She'd sought comfort by attending a support group for relatives of homicide victims, but didn't make it through. Everyone there knew who was responsible and had someone to blame. Bridget didn't know what had happened to her mother, nor who was responsible, telling the Kansas City Star, quote, "I wonder how she died. I wonder if she fought versus being calm. I look at people differently now. I look at people on the street and think, did you do it? Were you involved? I want her found, and I don't care if it's on Christmas Day," end quote. Unfortunately, Christmas would bring no answers, nor would New Year's, and soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. The reward for information continued to rise, reaching $10,000, where it still stands today. Investigators kept working, but the passage of time and their ability to dedicate hours dwindled slowly, and Shirley's case would end up moving across several different desks. Bridget attended vigils, support groups, tried to raise reward money, and even managed to hire a private investigator. But it always came back to the same dead end, the same absence of evidence. She was frustrated with investigators, with the persons responsible, with everything, and she felt powerless. Eventually, Bridget was forced to sell the home she grew up in, the home her mother and father had created together. Kansas City Sergeant David Bernard, when speaking to the Star, explained that no one really believed the 18-year-old's original story, but they simply didn't have enough to prove it wasn't true. It was like having a word on the tip of your tongue, but no way to summon the sound. In the first 3 years, police received a meager 50 tips. There were no new leads to track, no new suspects or clues to analyze. Everything was frozen. And while no one would directly say it, the message was clear. Their best chance of making an arrest would be locating Shirley's body, but they didn't even know where to begin looking. There were two persons of interest, but not enough to file charges or obtain warrants, not enough to do anything but wait. Bridget eventually came to the conclusion that her mother had likely been carjacked and was killed either because she resisted or perhaps because the person or persons responsible simply wanted to take a life. As she explained to the Star, quote, she was probably stopped at a light and somebody overpowered her, carjacked her, robbed her, and killed her, end quote. As Bridget struggled to live her life, she could never get out from under the dark cloud of her mother's loss. And while for her days passed like years, things continued moving in the world at large, and soon a decade had passed. In early 2014, what would have been Shirley's 83rd year of life, a new investigator was put in charge, one with a reputation for his tenacity and patience. Sergeant Everett Babcock had worked a lot of cold cases, and when Shirley's came into his possession, he was determined to break it, and he wasn't pulling any punches. When speaking to the Star, he explained, quote, "We hope to stir things up. I have a pretty good idea of who's responsible. As long as I'm around, he's not going to get any rest," end quote. There's only one consistent belief, one likely truth. More than one person knows the truth of Shirley's fate and possesses the knowledge which could not only advance the investigation, but grant her grieving children the ability to lay their beloved mother to rest beside their father, a man from whom she never wished to be away. According to Sergeant Babcock, he knows he's spoken to people who could easily answer every question with a single call, but for reasons passing understanding, they choose not to. When last seen, Shirley Ann McEwen was described as being a white female with gray hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing approximately 145 pounds. Shirley wears eyeglasses and has a pacemaker, but was in excellent health at the time of her disappearance and was not taking any daily medications. A description of what she was wearing the last time she was seen is unavailable, though many sites list her as having worn jeans that Saturday. Shirley was last seen near her home on East 44th Street in Kansas City, near the Independence Line, and was set to arrive to the 3400 block of Charlotte Street. She may have stopped off along the way, purchasing the chair or visiting a yard sale. She was driving a white 1990 two-door Cadillac DeVille at the time of her disappearance. She was 71 years old, and if alive today, she would have turned 90 in January. A devoted wife, loving mother, and caring friend, Shirley McEwen had dedicated her life to taking care of others. Then, on a quiet summer morning, she left home to help out at her daughter's house and never came back. Her daughters had been robbed of the ability to grieve, to know the truth of her fate, and to lay her to rest beside her beloved husband. There is no justice and there are no answers, and while everyone knows what happened, they've never been able to find Shirley and bring her home. The closest thing Bridget has ever had to a funeral was kissing the wall of Shirley's home on the day she had to sell it, saying goodbye to the woman who meant everything to her and the house where she grew up. It's an endless struggle that never gets easier. As Bridget herself told the Star, quote, Is she just thrown out in a field somewhere? Did they throw her in a dumpster? How would they feel if it was their grandmother or mother or sister? I want my mother's remains back. I promised my dad on his deathbed that I would take care of her. I've had such guilt for going out of town and leaving her. Finding the right program to help your child learn to read can be daunting. You have to find something that's both engaging and proven to get results. Hooked on Phonics has been the most trusted program to help kids learn to read for nearly 35 years, which is why I decided to get the program for my nephew. I really love that Hooked on Phonics lays out the basics and sets no expectations, instead taking you through step by step from how to correctly pronounce sounds to how to put the whole word together. When struggling to learn to read, my nephew can get really frustrated. But with Hooked on Phonics, it's not only easy, but it's fun. And he feels like he's really accomplished something tremendous. And he has. For a child who used to avoid anything that had to do with reading, I've already spotted him a few times looking through books with excitement, and having to ask him to sit down and learn has been replaced with him eagerly asking if he can read now. Hooked on Phonics is the learn-to-read curriculum that uniquely combines an amazing app with hands-on learning materials shipped to your home every month. With Hooked on Phonics, you get unlimited access to their powerful reading app, along with workbooks that give your child essential hands-on practice to reinforce the skills they're building in the app. Plus, you get storybooks written specifically to build your child's confidence and discussion questions to increase reading comprehension. Lessons take just 20 minutes or less, and the curriculum is guaranteed to help your child learn to read. Give your child the confidence that reading brings with Hooked on Phonics. Visit hookedonphonics.com/trace and receive your first month for just $1. That's hookedonphonics.com/trace. to get your first month of Hooked on Phonics for just $1. HookedOnPhonics.com/trace. Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that stops you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit, feeling the weight of everything just crushing down on me. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp isn't a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trace. Shirley McEwen left her home to go help out at her daughter's house while she was out of town. She never made it. Somewhere along the short 15-minute drive, the 71-year-old was attacked. Within 24 hours, she'd been reported missing by her daughter, and for more than a week, nothing developed. No leads or tips, nothing. Then, police are led to her car, a 12-year-old Cadillac, which she kept in excellent condition. They find it in a vacant lot in the middle of a neighborhood, covered by a tarp and casually camouflaged by tree branches and brush. At first, they think, since they've got her car, they might be able to figure out exactly where Shirley went that day, where she might have been attacked, and most importantly, where she might be now. Instead, they find a blood-soaked back seat and blood in the trunk. Such a large quantity of blood that it's ruled no one could have survived that massive loss. Now, it's a homicide investigation, and it doesn't take long to put the pieces together. An 18-year-old calls in, tells them he had the Cadillac. They search his house and find a chair that Shirley was planning to gift to her daughter, and it has her blood on it. Credit reports show the Cadillac was filled with gas 30 miles away, and surveillance footage shows a group of men in that Cadillac. So, what do we have here? Someone who admits to having driven the car, footage of people with the car, blood in the backseat, blood in the trunk, blood on a chair in the 18-year-old's home. It kinda seems like a slam dunk, doesn't it? In so many cases we examine here, they're trying to solve a disappearance with little more than a composite sketch, if they're lucky enough to have that. But here we've got evidence of a crime connected to several people, one of which admits to having been in possession of the victim's stolen vehicle. So how the hell is this case not solved? How has Shirley never been located? Because despite what they do have, they're missing several key pieces. No body, no murder weapon, no particular person they can, as of yet, prove was directly involved with what happened to Shirley. This isn't a case where we have a whole slew of theories to analyze, but rather a fairly concise concept of what happened and how. Where we come up short is proving who was responsible, why they did it, and how after 19 years, not a single person has come forward to share any information which can help break this case, see an arrest made, and hopefully result in Shirley's remains being returned to her family so they might put her to rest. Frankly, it's one of the more frustrating cases we've looked at because this isn't a case of having nothing to work with, but one where everything points in one direction, but there's not enough to actually do anything about it. We know that Shirley left her home on the morning of Saturday, August 24th, between 9 and 9:30. If she'd made no stops along the way, she would have arrived at her daughter's house sometime between 9:15 and 9:45, but we know that never happened. Police tried to track down the origin of the chair, which was in her car and then later found in the 18-year-old's home. The most likely scenario involves Shirley stopping somewhere between her home and Bridget's, where she bought the chair. Though I haven't seen if they've been able to completely rule out the possibility that she had purchased the chair previously and was only bringing it to Bridget's that day because she'd finished restoring it. The total distance between Shirley's home and Bridget's is just over 7 miles, and there's several different routes that can be taken. One route involves merging onto I-70 and would have placed Shirley in the area of Myrtle Avenue, 3 miles northeast of Charlotte Street. From there, the two primary routes would carry her either south to East 31st, where she'd then head east, then south on Euclid, east on 35th, and north on Charlotte. However, she also could have taken 27th east to Paseo south to 35th. She could also have taken Euclid to Linwood to Troost to 35th. Imagine a rectangle where the top and bottom are connected by an interlocking grid of streets running east to west and avenues running north to south. Depending on familiarity, the presence of a yard sale or another stop, there's a lot of different turns she could have made. The 3300 block of Highland near the intersection of 33rd, where her car was found, is 2 blocks north of 35th, 3 blocks east of Paseo, 1 block south of Linwood, 7 blocks east of Troost. She also could have gotten off I-70 early, exiting onto East 31st, which would carry her to Linwood, which she could have taken for several miles, or she could have stayed on 31st, traveling west to Euclid. Regardless of what way she took, if she's going west on 35th or Linwood, she'd have crossed Highland Avenue. Now, we don't know exactly where she was attacked, and maybe it's just me being jaded, but I find it highly unlikely that the location where she was overpowered, robbed, and murdered would be someplace far away from where her car was found, where she would have passed by that day. It just seems unlikely. Sure, she could have been attacked miles away, and it just happened to be a coincidence that her car ended up at Highland and 33rd. Stranger things have happened, but again, it seems unlikely. While investigators haven't shared too much about what they believe occurred, Bridget's been fairly forthcoming. In her mind, Shirley stopped at a red light, a stop sign, or was forced to stop somehow, at which time the killer or killers initiated a carjacking and robbery. That's a fairly likely assessment of how this may have happened, with Shirley being pulled from the car and pushed into the back seat. Why the assailants would have taken Shirley with them doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. I mean, maybe she saw their faces and they didn't want to be ID'd, but I'd imagine there's a different reason, and I see it as happening in one of two ways. Either Shirley was mortally wounded right then and there, and they took her with them to cover it up, or the plan originally wasn't just to carjack the elderly woman in the Cadillac, but to force her to withdraw money or maybe even lead them to her home where they might have the ability to steal valuables. At that point, Shirley either resists or maybe she tries to explain that, despite the Cadillac, she's not a rich woman living in a mansion with a lot of money in the bank. Whatever way it goes down, she ends up wounded. Since she's never been found, we don't know exactly how. I'd imagine she was either shot or stabbed, but now she's bleeding tremendously, and the assailants need to get somewhere to dump her as fast as possible. At some point, she may even have been forced into the trunk, perhaps after dying, or regrettably and horrifyingly, while she was dying. We know her credit card was used to purchase Gath in Olathe, Kansas, some 25 miles southwest of where her car was eventually found on Highland. This suggests that Shirley was likely taken down into Kansas, at which point her remains could have been left anywhere within 50 to 100 miles of that gas station. That leaves a lot of possibilities, a lot of farmland, bodies of water, places where it would be difficult to find anything if you didn't have an actual starting point, and even then it wouldn't be easy. I'm inclined to believe there's a connection there. Someone involved had the familiarity with that area, at least enough to suggest a location where they wouldn't be seen and they were unlikely to get caught. Perhaps one of the more perplexing issues at play here is the time during which the crime was committed, believed to be between 9:15 and 11 a.m. A brazen, daylight carjacking in an area that's highly populated. This would have had to have been done somewhere where the assailants were comfortable, knew no one would notice, or knew that if they did, they didn't report it. And I would also think that they'd want to have an escape route to follow should things go south. This is where the yard sale possibility comes in. Could Shirley have stopped off at some point and the assailants saw her and decided to follow her until she was in a quieter area or a place where they felt more familiar? Or was it just happenstance? An older woman driving down the road in a white Cadillac seems like an easy target. Being carjacked is bad enough. The murder was completely unnecessary, and you have to wonder if it was done in response to something, or simply because these people are cold-blooded killers. So then we turn towards the 18-year-old. Here's a guy who contacts police to report that he had been in possession of Shirley's car, had driven it, had removed items from it, and then he'd abandoned it once he learned where it had come from. So let's break this down. He claims to have purchased the Cadillac for approximately $55. Let me say that again. According to this 18-year-old, he bought a Cadillac in great condition for $55 and didn't know how the person he bought it from had come into possession of it. This gives a level of deniability, though I think logic would question just how plausible that deniability is. He admits to driving it around and only abandoning it after he learned about Shirley. Keep in mind, the back seat is soaked in blood and there's blood in the trunk, but he didn't know right away what had happened here. Then he, quote-unquote, abandons the car. What do you imagine when you think of an abandoned car? In my head, it's a vehicle left in the middle of nowhere or along the side of the road. They park the car, close the door, and walk away. Is it really abandoned when you park it beneath some trees, cover it with a tarp, and then throw leaves and branches on top of it to hide it? That doesn't sound like an abandoned car. It sounds like trying to hide the car until the situation cools down. Remember, this guy doesn't call in once he learns about Shirley's disappearance. He calls in after someone else leads police to the car, which he brilliantly abandoned on the same street he lives on. Perhaps what makes this so frustrating is we're obviously not dealing with a criminal genius here, nor someone who lies really well. The veracity of his claims is extremely weak, but without something to counter it, without the actual story, it's hard to prove he lied. Perhaps that was the point of coming down to the police station with two lawyers. Beyond admitting possession of the car, when the police search the home he lives in with his mother, they find some items connected to Shirley, including the chair that was in the car. Her blood is then found on that chair. So now you're supposed to believe that this guy bought a caddy for $55, didn't know it was involved in a crime despite blood in the backseat and trunk, and he also took stuff out of the car, including a chair that had blood on it, but again, didn't know where any of this stuff came from. Police don't think the story is legitimate, obviously, but there's no way to prove that, at least not without someone giving more information, new evidence, or possibly the discovery of Shirley's remains. Having the car, taking the chair, even being aware that a crime did occur doesn't directly link the 18-year-old to the original crime. There's a part of me that wonders if no charges were filed because police didn't feel secure enough about their evidence, or if perhaps the DA's office didn't want to move forward without more, likely up to and including Shirley's body and the murder weapon. So again, we pretty much know what happened here. Shirley was attacked, carjacked, robbed, and murdered. Her killer or killers then dumped her body, likely somewhere down across the Kansas line. At this point, the question becomes, was Shirley killed by someone or a group of people who then sold the car to a dumb 18-year-old as a way of distancing themselves from the crime, or was the 18-year-old involved? I mean, he has to know who he bought it from, right? That person was either involved in the initial crime or would have known who was. The problem is, if no one will talk, if no one will give information, if no one will give a name, it's not very easy to do much about it. And that's where I find the most frustration with this case. Police know that there's people who know the truth. Sergeant Babcock believes he's spoken to these people, but because they can't get anyone to speak up, the killers continue to go about their lives, while Shirley's family struggles every day with not being able to put her to rest. This summer will mark 19 years since Shirley McEwen was murdered, and we're basically in the same place we've been since the first month. Over the years, police have sent evidence off for additional testing, though what the results of that testing have been, we don't know. Sergeant Babcock has questioned the person he believes is responsible on several occasions, but can't get what he needs to file charges. That's where you come in. There are people out there with the truth. There are people who can do what is necessary to solve this case. The person or persons responsible for the murder of a mother and grandmother have friends, family, spouses, exes. They've talked. They've used this story to inflate their egos, to make themselves seem like they're badasses, because we all know how tough you've got to be to brutally murder an elderly woman. How many others have been hurt over the past 19 years because of these people? How many lives have been prematurely ended? How many families have been robbed of loved ones because no one can be bothered to pick up a phone and make an anonymous call? Over all these years, police have received only 50 tips. 50. I don't know if that's because people choose silence over truth or because no one knows this story. Outside of the Kansas City Star's impressive in-depth coverage, this story appears nowhere. Perhaps, together, we can spread the word, and someone might finally feel compelled to speak up. Or, they could choose to stand with the cowardly, murderous scumbags who killed a 71-year-old woman simply because they felt like it. Shirley's family hasn't been able to give her a proper burial. They haven't been able to truly say goodbye or allow their grief to process. They are frozen in time, stuck in a space where they know, but they don't know. Where they believe, but they can't prove. They want to see justice done. They want to see the truth revealed. But more than anything, they want to be able to pay their respects to the mother who made them who they are. To the woman who sacrificed and worked hard to give them a better shot at life. Even if you don't want to turn someone in, even if you don't want to get involved, you could at least send in an anonymous tip and tell them where to look so that Shirley can finally be found and brought home. To do any less, to stay silent, put Shirley's blood on their hands and yours as well. Because without someone coming forward, this case will remain open and unsolved. Are you unhappy with your smile? Well, thanks to Candid, you don't have to be. Thousands of people have used Candid, the clear, comfortable, removable, and practically invisible aligners to help straighten their teeth, and now they love their smile. Just like Justin from Atlanta, who says, "When I was younger, I used to have a gap in the front and on the side. I noticed that people would always look at my mouth first, so I was looking for a fix. Candid ended up being completely perfect for me. You can't stop me from smiling now. There's no comparison." Candid is here to help straighten your teeth so you can fall in love with your smile too. Your treatment is prescribed and closely monitored remotely by a licensed orthodontist who's an expert in tooth movement. You'll have the same quality of care you'd get from an in-office orthodontist from the comfort and convenience of your own home. While other companies use general dentists, Candid only works with orthodontists. The average Candid treatment is just 6 months. You'll start seeing results way before then, and it costs thousands less than traditional braces. Become your best you. Start straightening your teeth today. Right now, you can save $75 on Candid's starter kit. Go to candidco.com/trace and use code TRACE. That's candidco.com/trace, code TRACE. Take advantage of this limited time offer to save $75 on your starter kit. CandidCO.com/trace, code TRACE. Have you ever wished you had a pocket-sized guide to help you sleep, focus, act, and be better? Well, there is one, and if you have 10 minutes, Headspace can change your life. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace can really help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation just for you. Need help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions their members swear by. And for parents, Headspace even has morning meditations you can do with your kids. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. My brain never stops, and it can be difficult for me to take the time I need to slow everything down. Thanks to Headspace, I don't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out the best approach. I love how the infographics guide me along, and with session timers, I never lose out on a minute. Plus, with their email reminders, I never forget to take the time I need. All I have to do is tap the play button, and I'm off. Just 10 minutes later, I'm ready to take on the world again. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you, on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/trace. That's headspace.com/trace. for a free 1-month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/trace today. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Shirley McEwen, there's honestly not a lot of coverage out there. However, the Kansas City Star newspaper did the most in-depth and thorough investigating and reporting on this case, and their articles are available in newspaper archives and on their website. If you have any information about the disappearance of Shirley McEwen, please contact the Kansas City Police Department at 816-234-5136. You can also drop an email to missingperson@kcpd.org. You can call anonymously to Kansas City Metro Crime Stoppers at 816-474-TIPS. That's 816-474-8477. You can also visit kccrimestoppers.com or p3tips.com. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Since Trace Evidence has the most amazing listeners in the world, I wanted to ask you to take a second out of your day and do me a favor. Trace Evidence has been nominated for the Quite the Podcast Awards, and your vote means a lot. Please visit quitethethingsmedia.com/awards-voting. I'll put a link in the show notes, and there's already one on social media. There, you can cast a vote for Trace Evidence in the true crime section. I truly appreciate your vote because the more ears find Trace Evidence, the greater our ability becomes to share these cases and hopefully help find justice for the victims. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Aurora K, Bacon Bits the Cat, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Heather Louise, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levonen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Walter Jansen. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. Thank you all once again for listening, supporting the show, and for being the best listeners a podcaster could ask for. Until then, I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.